Blog Talk Radio.
We are all one planet, all one people of Earth, all one planet, sharing our living, our dying, our birth, and we won't stand by watching her die.
Welcome to Your Turn to Speak with your host, Beth Miller. All points of view must be brought to light if we're to reach the wisest solutions to challenges we face. Guests on Your Turn to Speak have unusual insights to bring to the collective conversation. They have been invited because of the positive impact of their loving presence on Earth. Though their ideas may be hidden by the glare of the mainstream focus, their perspectives are guaranteed to inspire and enrich us all. And now, here's your host, Beth Miller.
Welcome to Your Turn to Speak. I'm your host, Beth Miller. Before introducing my guest this evening, I would like to take a moment to thank songwriter and recording artist Molly Scott for her beautiful song, We Are All One Planet. This song truly sets the stage for the interview you are about to hear. If you'd like to obtain a copy of Molly's recording and check out her other extraordinary songs, you can visit her at mollyscott.com. I'd also like to mention something about our upcoming program schedule. Next week, our program will feature Dr. Richard Weisskopf, who will discuss his life as a physician and peace activist and his involvement in the group Physicians for Social Responsibility. And on March 25th, Dr. Joyce Hackett Smith Moore will speak on her experiences as an ordained spiritualist minister, and in particular about her work as an advocate for prisoners' rights. Right now, I have the privilege of having as my guest tonight Linda DiStefano. From the time she was a young girl, moved to tears by reading books like Black Beauty and other books about animals, Linda has had a deep love and compassion towards animals. Today, Linda is a powerfully strong and articulate advocate of animal rights and social justice and environmental protection. She is the president of the Syracuse, New York-based People for Animal Rights, an organization she helped found in 1982. She is also the conservation chair of her local Sierra Club and chair of the Biodiversity Vegetarian Outreach Committee of the New York statewide Sierra Club. And Linda is an active participant in the Alliance for a Green Economy, which is working for a nuclear-free and carbon-free New York State. It is with great honor and delight to present you my guest and dear friend, Linda DiStefano. Welcome, Linda. It is your turn to speak.
Hi, Beth, and you know I don't have any trouble speaking.
Well, that's wonderful. I was thinking that maybe before we go into depth about your current work, it would be interesting to hear about your earlier life experiences and life lessons that guided you toward becoming the person who you are today. So could you tell us, how did you happen to come to be an animal rights activist?
Well, I'm actually not very good at remembering much about my early life. I probably could do some therapy about remembering about my early life, but I remember as an adult having moved to Syracuse and doing some volunteer work with the Syracuse Peace Council, which is a very old grassroots peace and social justice organization that's still thriving, that I remember thinking, gee, the folks here who I really respect, they're into everybody's rights, but they seem to forget the animals. And at that same time, I read a book called Animal Liberation by Peter Singer, who's a philosopher. Mm-hmm. And that book was seminal in terms of reinvigorating the modern animal rights movement. So I decided, well, I'm concerned about farm workers' rights and about having peace instead of war and all sorts of things. Maybe it's time that I also included in my concern the other animals that we share the planet with.
Right. Right. What about your educational background? Does it kind of match your activism?
Well, I do have a master's in social welfare, and I worked in that area for a number of years at outpatient mental health clinic, also for a time at Utica State Hospital, which was the oldest state mental hospital at that time. The original building dated, I believe, from the Civil War era.
Wow.
I assume that's closed now.
Mm-hmm.
And I also did some child welfare work. So I guess I am the kind of person who tends to want to help if when I see a problem, when I see a person or an animal in pain, I'd like to empathize and try to do my part to make things better.
Right. Well, let's talk about People for Animal Rights.
Okay. I might mention that you are one of the three women who started People for Animal Rights in the fall of 1982.
Yes.
You and I and Jane Begley. Let's hear it for the three women. And we started very small, and we still are very small. We have about 200 members. We're all volunteers. Nobody's paid, ever has been. And our purpose is to promote the rights of animals and to protect the earth, which sustains us all, whether we're a person or a horse or a worm or an elephant or whoever.
Right. Right. And a part of People for Animal Rights has a focus on vegetarianism. Is that did you want to discuss a little bit about being vegan?
Sure. First of all, I guess I should make some definitions. A vegetarian doesn't eat any animals, whether that animal is a mammal or a bird or a fish. A vegan also accepts that, but then goes a step further and doesn't eat any animal products, particularly dairy and eggs. And for some people, the reason they are vegan, beyond being vegetarian, is they think that it's much healthier, that they feel, for example, that dairy is not a healthy product for human adults, that that's really just meant for the calf, and that the only milk we needed as babies was our mother's milk, not a cow mother's milk. And then other people, I say this is my primary reason. We are vegans because we realize that the dairy animals, for example, suffer just as much as the so-called beef cattle because they're used up by having to commercially produce a huge amount of milk. They live a much shorter time than their natural lifespan would be. And their babies are taken away from them almost immediately after birth because the milk is going to be sold for humans. And I actually, when I was visiting Costa Rica on a trip, one of the places they brought us on our tour was a small dairy farm. And it just happened that at that time they were separating the baby calf from his or her mother, and the mother and the baby were crying for each other, and
aww,
that really enforced that to me that this is such a cruel thing, that why would I imbibe something that's not even healthy for me and cause such suffering to these animals.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the chickens are typically kept in very small cages, and even the so-called free range usually just means that a huge number are kept in a very big building, and there's one little opening to a small area outside that most of the chickens can't even find because it's so small.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are very good reasons, I think, to be vegan. I know other people expand upon the social justice aspects of being vegan. It seems that a lot of the land that is used to grow food for the cattle could otherwise be growing food for the people who are hungry.
Yes, that's an excellent point that shouldn't be overlooked. If you take, let's say, an acre of arable land and you use that to grow, for example, grain that will be made into bread for people to eat directly, you're going to be able to feed a lot more people than if you use that same area of land to grow corn or some other grain that's going to be fed to cattle that are finished. They use the term finished on this kind of food. Then you are actually feeding fewer people because you're cycling that food through the animal, and the animal has his or her own body functions to take care of. So a lot of the calories and the food value is used just by the animal to maintain their life until they're brutally slaughtered. And another aspect is the environmental aspect. Focusing on dairy for a moment again, the animals that are called domestic ruminants, and that's cattle, goats, sheep, and bison, their digestive system is such that they burp out a huge amount of methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas. It's even more powerful than carbon dioxide, which is the one we most often hear about. Right. Carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere longer, but methane is more powerful at trapping the heat, which is causing the global warming, which is causing the climate crisis that we're all experiencing. And also the United Nations did a report pointing out that whether you're talking about animals used for their milk or used for their flesh, it's a very negative, significant problem for the environment in terms of water pollution, degradation of soil, destruction of habitat for wild animals, air pollution, etc.
Yes, I think in particular the whole issue about water. I happened to hear someone being interviewed the other evening on TV. He was an expert about investments, and he advised not to worry about investing in gold, but water is the thing to invest in, because it seems that water, really pure, drinkable water, is becoming more and more scarce, and more people need it. You know, they don't have as much easy access to it as they may once have had. So water is so precious now that we can't really keep pursuing things that are going to be polluting it even further.
That's right. Some people say that the next wars will be water wars.
Yes.
And we see what's happening in places in our own country like California that's still in the midst of a prolonged drought.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's not only the question of polluting the water, but it's also a question of how are you going to use the water. And you use more water, let's say, for a pound of beef than you would a pound of a vegetable. And I don't remember the figures in my head, but I've often seen that comparison. So mm-hmm. again, we don't want to use up our precious resource unnecessarily.
Well, we've talked about how a vegan lifestyle kind of is founded in good science as far as the environment and actually social justice goes. It's also scientifically founded to be healthy.
That's right. The American Dietetic Association has a paper on vegetarian and vegan, and they say for a vegetarian diet, of course, it's relatively easy to get various things that people think they need. So I'm going to focus on what they say about a vegan diet, which is that they say that a well-balanced vegan diet is healthy at all stages of life. In other words, for a pregnant woman, for her infant, for the child as he or she is growing, for an adult, and for old age. And that word, that phrase, well-balanced, is important for any way of eating.
Right.
So for the vegan way of eating, one of the things, I think the thing that you most have to remember to supplement is B12,
mm-hmm.
because there really is no way to get B12 if you're a vegan without supplementation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I myself take two sublingual B12 tablets. You know, twice a week I'll take one, so a total of two for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are a lot of resources, like one I'm looking at now from Vegan Outreach called Guide to Cruelty-Free Eating. And they have the daily recommendations for vegan adults. And they go through basically what we all need, but they tell how a vegan could get them. They go through B12, omega-3 fatty acids, calcium, vitamin D, iodine, vitamin A. And if people want to get that resource for themselves, they can go to veganoutreach.org.
Great. Yes, I know that it's kind of gets to be kind of humorous, actually, about it seems that a lot of people are extremely concerned about protein. They often ask me, well, if you're a vegan, how do you get your protein? And
now what do you say?
Well, there are so many protein options that, you know, go with legumes and dark leafy green vegetables. There's wonderful proteins and other, you know, minerals and nuts and seeds. A lot of vegetables have proteins in them.
That's right.
Actually, so and then of course there's the fortified milk products I often eat, you know, consume, like almond milk, and
that would be for your calcium, right? Fortified
yes,
with calcium.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
yes, calcium. So you know, I kind of think it's funny, but you know, with you know, not only the legumes, but like tofu and whole grains. And, you know, have a lot of protein, as well as hummus and the bean spreads. I like those. So, but, you know, it seems that quite often the typical response at first to people when they hear I might be a vegan or vegetarian, they'll say, well, gee, I hope you're getting enough protein and iron. Iron is another thing. And there again, those dark leafy greens, I think, have iron, but there again, for some it might be wise to get, you know, blood work and tested to see if they have enough iron levels, and there again that might need a supplementation. I'm not sure. It probably depends on the person's particular body and needs and, you know.
Yeah, I agree with you that just like people who aren't vegans, there's going to probably be a fairly wide range of what people are bringing to the table, so to speak, with their genetic makeup and what they ate for the early part of their lives. And so some people may need iron supplementation. Every once in a while, have my general physician do blood work, because he just does that routinely anyway for his patients. And mine has always been so good that he doesn't even do it that often for me.
Yeah, interesting. Yes.
And getting back to your point about the scientific basis for healthy vegan eating, there are mainstream organizations like the American Heart Association, American Cancer Society, who have talked about the importance of eating a lot of whole, fresh vegetables and fruits, and reducing consumption of animal products and animal flesh. They don't go as far as to say vegan. I think that probably they themselves are not vegan, so that would seem like a strange thing for them to say.
Right.
But they do talk about how meat is implicated in the major killers of people in the U.S., heart disease, stroke, diabetes, certain types of cancer, like prostate cancer, is connected with a meaty diet. And people who want to find out more about science-based nutrition for vegans, I would recommend that they go to the website of Michael Greger, who is an MD. He's a vegan, and he specializes in vegan nutrition. He's very concerned about being accurate. He will have himself, he'll put himself into a library and look through all of these professional journals and be sure that he knows what he's talking about, and then he'll put the information into digestible form for us lay people. He also has DVDs besides his web page. If you sign up, you can get his nutrition facts. I think it's once a week. And you just go to nutritionfacts.org.
Oh, that's great, Linda. You know, one of my favorite resources is Dr. Neil Barnard. He also is a very good advocate of vegan nutrition.
Yes, tell us more about him.
Well, I believe he is a member of the, I don't know if it's the Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine.
That's right.
PCRM. In fact, he started it.
Right. And he is on YouTube, and he has also websites that give a lot of good insight into the science of vegan eating and nutrition. But, you know, Linda, one of my, you know, also concerns is not only, you know, for the body, mind, and soul aspects of being vegan, but there are also there is a spiritual price to pay for the way we commodify other living beings, the meat, the animals we raise for meat. You know, we have such a disconnect from the idea that, you know, these are sentient beings who have the capacity of suffering. And I think that culturally, you know, when so many of us, you know, are still back in this sort of philosophy of everything is kind of like a machine and a commodity, that we are disconnected from the spiritual reality of these sentient beings. And somehow or other, people don't really see that, you know, well, yes, I eat a cow, but I wouldn't ever think of eating a dog, you know, you know, but what's, you know, we're all animals here, you know, so I think that we pay a price for not, you know, having a more of a reverence towards other living beings spiritually as well, but that's just my philosophy here too. So.
Oh, I think that's a beautiful philosophy, and I think it's very valid.
Yes. So, well, tell our listeners if they would like to, you know, join PAR or learn a little bit more about PAR, how could they get in touch?
Well, our website is peopleforanimalrightsofcny.org. And if they go there, they can find out some of the activities that are upcoming, and we have archives of activities we've done over the years. What's coming up now is Tuesday, May 6th, a very beautiful and touching, I think, film called Minds in the Water, and that's going to be at the Onondaga Free Library on Onondaga Hill, which is near the city of Syracuse, at 6:30 p.m. And it is about the need to protect the oceans and the dolphins and whales, and it was put together by a group called Surfers for Cetaceans. And as you probably know, the cetaceans include the whales, the dolphins, and there's a third category I'm not thinking of right now, porpoises.
Oh, yeah.
One of the very interesting people that's shown throughout this film, he's sort of the star of the film, is a professional surfer. And he decided at some point that he enjoyed the ocean so much that he has a responsibility to give back to help protect the ocean from pollution and to also protect the beings that live there, particularly the whales, dolphins, and porpoises. And some of the scenes show these wild dolphins just riding the surf, as well as showing the people riding the surf.
Oh, great.
And then there is one very sad part that's hard to watch. Every year in Japan, there is a cove that these fishermen herd the dolphins into and then slaughter them, and they show that, you know, with the water all turning red and these brave women and men surfers going in there and putting their bodies between the dolphins and the fishermen. And the fishermen were very angry. In fact, one of them was actually assaulting this poor woman in the water. Mm. And they weren't able to stop the slaughter, but they made their point, you know.
Yes,
and they showed one woman who she got out, and it was just so touching. She was just sobbing and crying, and it was just so hard for her to be there and to see the slaughter. But I give her such credit for being there.
Right. If I recall, our ambassador to Japan, Caroline Kennedy, also was kind of made an infamous Twitter about her concern about that very ritual.
Oh, good. I didn't know that. Good for her.
Yes, yes.
Well, and then another thing that people can stop by if they're in the Syracuse area and say hello to us is we're going to be having a table and samples, free samples of vegan cookies at Green Planet Grocery, which is on West Genesee Street in Syracuse. And that will be on Saturday, March 15th from 11:30 until 5. And we're just now about to send to the printer our spring-summer issue of our newsletter that comes out twice a year. And if people choose to join us, which is $10 a year for an individual, or $15 for a family, or $100 for life membership, they will get the newsletter twice a year, and they'll know about all our activities. Also, one of the ways we encourage people to try being vegans and to stick with it is we have vegan socials. You don't have to be a vegan to come to them, but it's a place where you can try tasty vegan food. Sometimes they're at Strong Hearts Cafe, which is a vegan restaurant in Syracuse, and sometimes we have potluck vegan socials at different members' homes.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fabulous, because I do think that I don't know about you, but sometimes I think the culture is actually hostile and towards vegans in many situations, that it is so important to find community, a community of others who celebrate the vegan lifestyle.
Definitely, and I would ask you to please tell our listeners about the group you started.
Well, since I moved from Syracuse about 25 miles west into a little city called Auburn, New York, we started the Auburn Area Vegans, and we meet once a month and share delicious vegan recipes. And we basically are mostly kind of a social organization that exchanges recipes and camaraderie. We haven't really had a lot of speakers, although occasionally we go to different places to meet, such as an organic heirloom farm was one of the places we met at first.
I remember being there.
Yes.
That was very nice.
Yes, and it is. It's fun to kind of support the farmers who are growing organic foods, and, you know, and we're learning more and more about how important soil is you know, in growing these healthy foods. So, yeah, it's I'm very happy with the Auburn area vegans, and I'm hoping we will grow in numbers over time. We had 15 people come to our last meeting, which I thought was, you know, very good. And we've, you know, so we're getting there. We do outreach. For example, there was a seed-to-table event recently at our local public theater. And many of the farmers and other community-supported agriculture representatives came and had tables, information tables. One of the tables were a cancer prevention table that talked about the importance of eating fruits and vegetables and legumes. And so there was also an outreach to try to encourage low-income people who might not be able to afford some of the organic produce in the grocery store to learn how to grow their own food. So in some of our housing complexes, they've started community-based gardens now. So, you know, there's some really nice things happening in terms of raising people's awareness of, you know, eating well, feeling well, and, you know, so we go from there.
And how would people get a hold of Auburn Area Vegans?
Well, we just started a website, and it's auburnareavegans.webs.com. And it's under construction, but you can still get the general, you know, statistics of where we meet and when. And we have a recipe of the month we usually put on it. But I'm still kind of learning the how to construct it so that we can incorporate more links and articles and things like that. So, but it is up and running. If people would like to visit, we'd love to have them come.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You mentioned just a minute ago cancer prevention, and I wanted to give the listeners another resource, and that is a group called Coalition for Cancer Prevention Through Plant-Based Eating, and that's the group of a registered dietitian in New York called George Eisman. I've met George at various events. He does go around and speak to groups. I'm thinking maybe it'd be good to have him speak to our People for Animal Rights group at some point. Mm-hmm. And I asked him whether people could contact him if they had questions about their iron content and being vegan or anything else, because he definitely is a vegan and talks about vegan nutrition, and he said, sure. And so he gave me two things. He gave me his website, and he gave me his email address. So may I give those two now?
Sure. Please do.
All right. www.coalitionforcancerprevention.org.
Great.
And his, go ahead.
Just a reminder to our listeners that this program will be archived on freespiritbroadcasting.com, so you can come back at any time in case you don't have your pencil and paper right here. You can listen to this broadcast once again.
And do people know that they can call in and ask questions and make comments today?
Yes. I think that if anyone would like to call in, they can, let's see, they can, it's, the call-in number is area code 646, and it's 727-3116. If anyone would like to call in, they may. Absolutely.
And I do have George's email, too.
Oh, good, yes.
Which is G. Eisman, and his last name is spelled E-I-S-M as in Mary, A-N as in Nancy, 2004 at yahoo.com.
Great. Well, maybe we should move along to find out more about your role as conservation chair of the local Sierra Club.
Okay.
What does that involve?
Over the years, it's involved various causes. The two things that I spend most of my time on now, as far as the environmental protection, besides encouraging veganism, is to try to save our beautiful New York State, particularly upstate New York, where you and I both live, from fracking for natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been a movement that Sierra Club and many other organizations have worked together very enthusiastically, and so far very successfully. We've held off fracking for 5 years now. And the longer we hold it off, the more people, I think, realize how bad it would be, because we have the sad example of our neighboring state, Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
that has thousands of gas wells. I guess I should define fracking for readers or listeners who may not know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a method of extracting the gas, and sometimes oil as well, from very tight shale formations.
Mm-hmm.
And this is different from the old-fashioned way of getting gas and oil, where you would tap into basically a pool of this material, and it would come up, and there would be probably environmental problems connected with it, but not nearly as much as this new method, where the industries that make money off of this want to get the last drop of oil and gas from our poor, fractured mm-hmm. earth. So they drill way down into the earth. They put explosives down there. They then drill sometimes up to a mile laterally, and more explosives. Some of the material that goes down is toxic. It comes up again, so you have toxic material flowing back. You also have natural radioactivity that occurs in the shale, so you have contaminated water. What are you going to do with it? Sometimes it's sent to municipal water treatment centers that really are not geared to treating this kind of thing. They're geared to treating your normal sewage.
Right, right.
And then there's also the misuse of water. You have to use a huge amount of water in this process.
Mm-hmm.
And here we're facing climate crisis. And even though we're blessed so far in upstate New York with ample water, there have been attempts to steal our water to be used in other states. In fact, one of the lawyers associated with the statewide Sierra Club brought a successful lawsuit against the town of Painted Post in New York State that wanted to sell water for fracking in another state. I think it was Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And Painted Post is appealing that, so I don't know who will eventually win, but it certainly points out the problem, polluting water and using water inappropriately.
Right.
And so what Sierra Club and these other organizations really stress is that we have to move quickly and urgently to other ways to have our have a reasonable lifestyle, not an excessive lifestyle, a reasonable lifestyle, which
mm-hmm.
would include energy conservation. You know, I remember one of the neighborhoods I lived in, the people next door to me were renting, but so they didn't pay the heat bill. And it could be like a cold winter day, and presumably they had the heat pumped up, and rather than turning the heat down, they would open their window and let all this precious heat out into the atmosphere.
So a lot could be done to reduce the use of oil and gas, just simply by being a little more conservative about how, you know, we use our furnace thermostat, and you know, we can take measures to conserve.
Exactly. And then besides energy conservation, there's energy efficiency, which would be things like using Energy Star appliances that use less energy than the old models of refrigerators, for example. And we can be very aware of how we build our new buildings so they're more energy efficient. And then we really have to move quickly on a large scale to things like solar, wind, biothermal, both as individuals and government, businesses. There's a building in Manhattan, I believe, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's a huge building with a lot of floors and an unbelievable number of windows. And the man who bought it decided that he was going to put the expense in to replace all those windows that were leaking heat and put in very energy-efficient, double-paned windows, which he did. And he said that he expects to get his money back in a fairly short period of time because he's going to save so much energy. Right. In the meantime, he's helping the planet. And then I think of all those buildings in New York City that could have solar panels on them.
Right.
So there's so much that we need to do, and that's part of what I'm doing with Sierra Club.
No, that's fantastic. If you want to, if you want to give contact information for the Sierra Club, you're welcome to do that as well, Linda.
Well, I think what I'll do is I'll give the contact information for the committee that I'm involved with on the statewide level for the Sierra Club,
okay,
which, as you mentioned earlier, is the Biodiversity Vegetarian Outreach Committee.
Okay.
And we
great.
Use the word vegetarian, but really it's vegan outreach.
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't want to scare people away right away.
Right.
And if people go to that, and I'll give that site in a moment, they'll not only get a lot of information that will, you know, be, some of them will be scholarly articles supporting what we talked about earlier about veganism and environmental protection. There'll be a whole bunch of vegan recipes. But they can also then move from that page to other Sierra Club pages for the chapter, because we have a lot of different committees. We have on the Adirondacks and on the fracking and on this, that, and the other thing. So here is the site. It is New York 2, the numeral 2, dot Sierra Club dot org slash conservation slash biodiversity.
Great.
And I did want to at some point, when you want to do it, talk about another organization I'm involved with, which is Alliance for a Green Economy.
Right, right. Please talk about that.
Okay. Well, this is a relatively new group, and it formed around two things we want to see for New York State, the whole planet really, which is a carbon-free and a nuclear-free future.
Right.
And so the carbon-free part would be all the things we've talked about before, you know, not relying, not extending our reliance on oil and gas, you know, weaning ourselves off of that, and also not promoting animal agriculture. Alliance for a Green Economy doesn't deal with the animal agriculture part, but I'm adding that as a reminder to people that that's a very important factor as well because of the methane emissions from the ruminant animals. But the other factor that is very important is the nuclear-free. And we have 36 miles from Syracuse, and I live right near Syracuse, three nuclear power plants on Lake Ontario, two of which are very old and not in good shape. And they are the same design as the GE-produced nuclear plants that melted down at Fukushima, Japan, three years ago. And, you know, sometimes people will say, well, oh, so what? You know, we're not going to have a tsunami here. You don't need a tsunami. All you need is something that is going to take out the power at the nuclear plant. And what we have is ice storms. Oswego County is very well known for its really tough weather, even more than, you know, Syracuse. And so if you have an ice storm that takes out the power lines, then you can't keep the nuclear fuel, which gets very hot, cool, and you can have a meltdown. So we would like to see these plants phased out as soon as possible.
Right. It just seems the best, the better part of wisdom. You know, as long as we can, you know, use our minds to come up with these alternative energy sources, it's kind of archaic to even think about nuclear power right now.
It really is. We're just fortunate we haven't had a catastrophe yet here.
Yes.
And if people want to know more about that group, mm-hmm. it's AllianceForAGreenEconomy.org.
Okay, that was easy enough.
I hope we have hundreds of people who are sitting there writing all this down. But as you said, we do have the archive if they don't want to write it down now.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Linda, tell us something about your family.
Well, I'm an only child. I grew up with very loving parents. I was very fortunate. First in the city of Schenectady, and then when I was about 8 years old, we moved to Rotterdam, which is a suburb, and lived in a small but cozy house with a nice backyard and front yard. And both my parents liked to garden. My dad did vegetable gardening, and we had a couple fruit trees, and my mom did flower gardening. And I was raised on, you know, the typical meat and potatoes kind of diet. It wasn't until I became an adult that I realized the connection between my concern about animals and eating them.
Yeah.
And my mom and dad both died in 2003, so I really miss them.
Yes.
But I still have my mother's sister, who will be turning 90 in October.
Wow.
So about two or three times a year, three times actually, my husband Richard and I go and visit there in Schenectady, and we celebrate the May birthdays, and we celebrate the fall birthdays, and then we celebrate Christmas together.
Oh, that's nice. Wow. What other activities do you engage in for fun and enrichment?
Well, I really like to dance. Dancing is one of my favorite things to do.
You know, Linda, because I've been involved with animal rights work myself, it does become very grim when you courageously face some of the realities about how we as human animals treat other animals. And I think it's wonderful for you to be able to, you know, involve yourself with something like dancing and, you know, something that can help you connect with your joy, because believe me, I know the sacrifice it involves to stay the course and work in this particular field of animal welfare. So I'm so glad you like to dance, Linda.
I do, and I think that, you know, we all have a right for joy and happiness and pleasure in our life, and I'm certainly no saint. I don't plan to just be helping animals or helping people or helping the planet. I plan to just keep putting time aside to have fun, and I also like to do Zumba. I belong to a singing around the piano group and two Spanish conversation groups. And I like to do gardening. I do flower gardening. I guess I picked that up from my parents. My husband and I like to go for walks in the nice weather. And today, even though it was still kind of snowy and drippy and icy, we enjoyed walking in the sun. Because we know tomorrow there's supposed to be up to 16 inches of snow.
Yes, it's that sun when it comes out those first few days of spring, even though they're probably going to be, you know, bordered by a little bit more of winter's last lashes. It is wonderful to feel that sun, isn't it?
Oh yes.
So, well, I wanted to kind of mention that I read your article, which was published in the weekly newspaper, the Syracuse New Times, entitled Earth Companions, and I thought it was a phenomenal article, and I wondered if you would be willing to just share some of the article on air?
Sure. I was trying to make the point by using specific examples that other animals have qualities similar to what we appreciate in ourselves, like compassion and intelligence and the desire to live a life that's normal for them and natural for them. Mm-hmm. And so a couple examples I could give is there was a situation in which whales were being pursued by whalers with their harpoons, and one of the whales was struck mortally and was dying, and her mate could have escaped, could have kept going away from the killer ship, but he returned to be with her and stayed with her until he was killed also. Mm-hmm. And then there was a case a few years ago of a cow who wanted to live so badly, and you know, I think cows is not the most graceful or light-footed creatures, but she managed to jump a fence at the slaughterhouse. And the slaughterhouse was actually in New York City, and she was wandering the streets of the city trying to get away from this horrible place where she was going to be killed. And the media found out about it, and they started, you know, following her and telling people about her. And even people, I'm sure, who eat cows, when they saw this particular individual and how much she wanted to live, they were rooting for her.
Uh-huh.
And so they finally were able to capture her without hurting her, and she was brought to a farm animal sanctuary where she's living out her life in peace.
That is so fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And then I also wanted to say that even if an animal is dumb according to what we think of as dumb, or not attractive in terms of what we think of as attractive or not, like, you know, a lot of people think that cats are beautiful, which I do because I have two cats, but they may not think that a snake is beautiful, for example. Mm-hmm. That, in a sense, doesn't matter, because what really matters, the bottom line is, does this being have the ability to suffer, and does he or she want to live their natural life without being that life being cut short unnecessarily by us?
Right.
And, you know, there may be societies still that are living so simply off the land that they hunt and gather, and, you know, that's how they exist. I'm not saying people don't have a right to do what they have to do to exist, but I think those societies must be very rare now in this planet. Mm-hmm. We're so industrialized. And so I'd say for people who live in this country, why would we need to do that? Why would mm-hmm. we need to cause that suffering? And it's not just the question of eating animals. It's a question of animal suffering in labs when there are more modern ways and often cheaper, more reliable ways to find out how to treat human diseases. Instead, I think in part because of just inertia, people are trained a certain way. They're used to getting grants to use animals to inflict diseases on these animals and then use various treatments to see if any of them work. And so often this is just led astray mm-hmm. because these other animals don't necessarily react the way we do.
Mm-hmm.
There are differences even how mice and rats respond to certain chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And then there, of course, there the companion animals, the dogs and cats, and we urge people to be really responsible and have their animals spayed and neutered, because there are so many animals that just end up abandoned on the street, other animals that are turned into the shelters, but the shelters are overcrowded, and so they have to euthanize many of the animals, healthy animals, that could find a good home if there were enough good homes. Another thing to think about is animals used in cruel entertainment, like rodeos or circuses.
Right.
The methods of training these animals are very cruel, and there's nothing natural, for example, about an elephant being chained 23 hours a day in a little cramped space and then being taken out just to do stupid tricks.
Right.
And you know, I love places like the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee, where some of these animals, thank goodness, before they, some of them died in captivity, but others were rescued before they died. And now they're living wonderful lives, this huge acreage they have and natural ponds that they can swim in and they, wonderful treats to eat, and people take such good care of them. It just makes me very happy.
Yes, and it's kind of a climate that they're a little bit more used to, too, than here, like in upstate New York.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Linda, before we close, because I can't believe it, it's almost time for us to conclude, but if you would like to, give our listeners the gift of an image of the world that you would like to see come into existence that is different than the world we live in now. I know that in some ways, by what you've described, you've given us that image, but if I thought I would give you one chance to kind of put it into a little brief kind of snapshot of what the world would be like if your dream
could
come true.
Well, I would say that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
If your dream could come true.
I would say one of the things that would be important would be for us to realize that we live on a small planet. And that although we constantly hear from the media and from other parts of our society that the economy must grow, population of any given area must grow, we are beyond that. You know, that might have been true a long time ago when there were relatively few humans. But right now, we have to get a hold of the fact that there's overpopulation of humans, which is mm-hmm. resulting in a lot of suffering for many of the humans. We have to be able to provide people with the resources they need to choose the number of children they want to have. And for our economy, we also can't just keep growing because our natural resources are limited. Instead, we have to be fair about how wealth is distributed. Even in our country now, there's a terrible gap between the obscenely rich and mm-hmm. the shrinking middle class and really poor people, including homeless people.
Right.
So I'd like a world in which there would be a respect for all of us, people and animals and the earth, and we would all enjoy a good life without excessive consumption or waste.
Oh, Linda, that is absolutely beautiful. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. And I look forward to, in the future, having you back on.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Thank you, Beth. I'm glad you're having these radio programs. And I have to hand it to you to come up with something new every week.
Oh, well, we'll see what we can do here. But again, Linda, thank you so much. And I guess this will conclude this episode of Your Turn to Speak. I just want to remind the listeners that this coming week, next Tuesday at 6 o'clock, my guest will be Dr. Richard Weisskopf, who will discuss his life as a physician and peace activist. And until then, I would say, may your voice be heard.
We are all
You have been listening to Your Turn to Speak with host Beth Miller. Each week, Beth features guests whose important views are often overlooked in the mainstream dialogue. You can listen to this show again at freespiritbroadcasting.com. And be sure to tune in next Tuesday at 6 p.m. Eastern for another live, inspiring conversation on Your Turn to Speak.